Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Did you know that T-Rex got cancer, or that flamingos have heart attacks, and that koalas get the clap? It's all true, and understanding animal health might help doctors treat their human patients. At least that's what one doctor says. Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz is a cardiologist at UCLA Medical Center and a medical consultant to the Los Angeles Zoo. She's also the co-director of UCLA's Evolutionary Medicine Program. And all this overlapping work got her thinking, what if animals aren't all that different from humans? That thought led her down a rabbit hole to research that documents health similarities between animals and the human animal. And she details these in a book called Zubiquity, Astonishing Connections Between Human and Animal Health. And we welcome Barbara to the show. Thanks a lot for being willing to talk with us.
Oh, happy to be here.
And you know, Barbara, in your book, you're very open about the professional divide between veterinarians and doctors who care for humans. It actually seems like sometimes it verges on hostility.
As a profession, we physicians have many laudable traits, but I think that there can be some snobbery sometimes among physicians about not just, you know, veterinarians, but non-MD doctors, for example, and other members of the healthcare teams who have a lot to offer. My own experience was really instructive. I mean, I had this wonderful opportunity to participate as a physician on a medical advisory board of our local zoo. And one of the things that started happening to me was that I became incredibly admiring of these doctors because of the breadth of knowledge they needed to have.
Do you mean veterinarians?
Veterinarians, yes, the animal doctors, exactly, the veterinarians, because they're trained comparatively from the first day. And comparative method means when they're learning about the heart, they're learning about a fish heart and a bird heart and a mammal heart and a reptile heart and all that can go wrong and, you know, all the development. So they have to know a kind of a species spanning everything compared to us. We focus on one animal, Homo sapiens. And so over the course of the years that we were researching and writing, we had lots and lots of opportunities to interview veterinarians and animal experts. And we heard that, you know, there can be barriers to collaboration that just have to do with our fields not understanding each other enough. And frankly, I think just not having enough opportunity to hang out together, to, you know, to talk and have conversations about the same problems that we're treating just in different species.
Is there an example of some kind of medical ailment, some kind of illness an animal has that veterinarians knew about first and that could have been applied to human medicine earlier if the doctors and veterinarians had been talking?
Really interesting experience I had at the zoo, which led me to think, my God, there may be all this knowledge hiding in plain sight on the animal side, had to do with a cardiovascular diagnosis. One day I was at the zoo, and we were going to do an ultrasound on a little tamarin. Tamarin are these really adorable Central American monkeys. They live at the top of the canopy of the rainforest, and they're really cute. And this particular monkey, they were concerned, was developing heart failure. So we were going to do an ultrasound of her heart. And as she was getting sleepy from sedation, I crouched down, and I looked into her eyes to create like a trust bond, you know, really like, and I said, oh, you're so cute, Spitz and Boobin.
And Spitz and Boobin was the monkey's name.
Spitz and Boobin was her name.
Okay.
And, you know, this is something that I think, you know, I did as a reflex. I would do it with a child. I would do it with a young patient. And it was just an impulse to want to connect and reassure the animal through that kind of interaction. And the veterinarian put his hand on my shoulder and he said, please stop doing that. You're going to give her capture myopathy. I had never heard of capture myopathy. And I learned that it's this syndrome that veterinarians have known about for decades. I mean, there's a literature on it dating back to the 1950s. And it's a syndrome where animals, when they're scared, particularly when they're terrified, when they're being chased, for example, by a predator, when they're restrained, that they can have this surge of adrenaline that can poison muscles in their body, including their heart muscle, and that they can die from it.
It's basically you're so frightened you have a heart attack.
Right. The syndrome of fear-induced heart failure or stress-induced heart failure, it really reached prominence in the human medical literature around the year 2000 or so, when a number of Japanese cardiologists characterized this syndrome called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which was essentially an individual who had an intense emotional experience that led to this brief form of heart failure that in some instances was fatal. But the part of it which was really exciting was that veterinarians and wildlife biologists have known about this and had ways of treating it and even preventing it that we humans had no knowledge of and no reason to even think to access the animal literature to find out about it.
In your book, you have so many interesting examples of how humans and animals have similar health issues, you know, from eating disorders to fainting to heart attacks, from fright to obesity. But it seems like it's not that we are going to necessarily find a treatment for the human illness once we realize that animals have it too. Is it not quite that black and white?
Well, I happen to think that by bringing veterinary and human medicine closer together, that we will actually find a better way to practice medicine and for both animals and humans, and ultimately pursue the kind of investigations that can lead to cures, again, to benefit patients of all species. But even if these are early days and we're just now coming together as two professions, there are still some really important perspectives that I think we can get from the veterinary side. Take the example of overweight in animals. When I see patients who are significantly overweight, I talk to them a lot about, you know, what we ought to do, and most of the interventions have to do with them. They need to eat less, they need to exercise more, they need to be, you know, more careful about what they're putting into their mouths. But veterinarians and animal experts, when they confront overweight animals, for example, companion animals or some zoo animals, they really look at the environment. And they modify the environment to make it less, the word is obesogenic, that is less an environment that leads to obesity. One of the things we learned is that from veterinary nutritionists, most species of animals, if they're given ready access to abundant food, they're going to overconsume. So one of the ways the veterinarians will intervene if an animal is overweight is they make it harder for an animal to access its food. They actually create these enrichment toys where an animal needs to forage and poke its nose in and bat a ball around just to pull out the browse or whatever the treat is. And it's really interesting because now some public health experts on the human side are beginning to also consider the obesity epidemic less as a problem about individual issues and more of a landscape, of an environmental problem.
Dr. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz is a cardiologist at UCLA Medical Center and the author of Zubiquity, Astonishing Connections Between Human and Animal Health. Barbara, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.